Welcome to episode 3 of the Nothing But Nylon podcast. This is the Nylon Calculus podcast. Joining us today is Max Szymanski. Max is a writer for Nylon Calculus and a former member of the basketball analytics team for Davidson University. You can follow Max on Twitter at @shymax. That's S-C. H-I-M-A-X. Max, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. This is the first time I've ever done anything like this, so I'm really excited to do this. Hopefully I don't make too big a fool of myself.
I'm sure you'll be fine. Generally, the foolishness on the podcast comes from me, so we'll see how it goes. So just to kick things off, how long have you been into basketball, and like sort of have you're a lifelong fan, or did you get into it relatively late, or sort of what was your, I guess, origin story in being a basketball fan?
I get into basketball. I've been into basketball since I was a little kid. Grew up in the Madison, Wisconsin area. So grew up a huge like Wisconsin Badgers fan, followed a lot of the early 2000s. Badgers teams, you know, like a young Devin Harris, and those teams were my favorites. And then I followed the Bucks a little bit when I was younger, and then as I got a little older, kind of went away from it. And then as I got towards the older end of high school and college, got back to the NBA, and now follow mostly the Bucks and the Warriors, given that I went to Davidson College, and that's where Steph Curry's from. And then also I interned with the Hornets this past spring, and so got to kind of see the inner workings of that franchise run by the great one, Michael Jordan.
That's pretty cool. So it's Davidson College. I think I might have said Davidson University, but I guess it's Davidson College.
A lot of people get that one messed up.
it's really cool. You've had a lot of interesting experiences. So I know that you're a swimmer and a pretty good one, and you swam for Davidson. Are there analytics for swimming, like just beyond your times, or is that kind of the extent of it?
There isn't that much that's been developed. That's one thing actually at Davidson. Originally started, the whole analytics program there originally started as just an independent study for one student who wanted to look at basketball data. And in the, my professor, Dr. Tim Chartier, would have more on this, but it's probably been 6 or 8 years since that started. And now they're doing analytics for probably a dozen sports there, with swimming included as one of them.
So is that an endorsement then that if you want to do, if you're a high school kid and want to do sports analytics, that, to go to Davidson?
I would say that they've got a pretty good program going there, and it's only getting better by the day. You know, when I was there, I was one of the older guys doing it. Most of the people there were freshmen and sophomores doing it, as I was doing it during my senior year, and I could not believe how smart these kids were. And I thought, you know, this is going to be a really strong program for long after I'm here. Yeah, I would 100% endorse that program. And Dr. Chartier has done a really great job of not only coming up with analytics for college teams, but he's really into developing analytics for high school and even like middle and elementary school kids. He's really pushing a program to try and get those kids involved as early as possible, because it's a really fun way to learn math.
Yeah, I was going to say that is I know. In the Nylon email thread and also in the general hardwood paroxysm tree, there are a lot of teachers and former teachers. Ian Levy, the guy that sort of created what has become the Nylon Calculus, was a teacher at one point, and I know that a lot of teachers find that it's a useful way to get kids into math, and I certainly find learning about statistical concepts a lot more interesting through a basketball perspective or even, you know, any other sport than sort of a dry example of, I don't know, census data or something like that. So it's definitely I think a good way to go about it. Analytics for middle school and elementary school kids in their particular leagues sounds pretty intense, but intense in like probably the best kind of way.
Yes.
So when you were doing work for the basketball team, you know, without giving anything away or sort of getting yourself in trouble for giving away any kind of secrets, what were the, like the general sorts of things that the basketball team was interested in learning about?
I think it was it actually starts on our end, or it starts really just a conversation about basketball, really. And when they say, you know, we're looking for some way to do this, or we'll say, have you guys ever thought about maybe looking at this? And then we'll just start spitballing back and forth, and all of a sudden we'll have something, and you know, we'll just kind of run with it and see where it goes. But I mean, just the day-to-day stuff, we'll do like scouting reports, and there was another kind of section that I was more in that was more of, we called it R&D. And that was just kind of looking at, you know, maybe metrics or new ways to kind of take data and use it to describe things that maybe people haven't really thought of yet in the college game, or we haven't thought of at the team level yet. So we had a real diverse group of guys working on a whole bunch of projects.
So it sounds like, to some extent, the dial that it was much more of a dialogue in terms of how projects were developed or ideas for you guys to dive into. So you might have an idea and then suggest it and say, "Is that something you'd be interested in?" Rather than like it just being kind of directed by the basketball team saying, "Hey, like, can you look into this for us and like do the numbers on it?"
Right. And we had to kind of be, you know, be wary of things such as like, we would say something, you know, would this be helpful to you guys? And it was always up to them if they thought that was going to be something they could use or not. And so that was our big thing, was that we wanted to be able to, if we were going to give them information, give them things that were of use to them. And I think that was the biggest thing that we tried to focus on was, you know, it's fun to do a lot of these investigations into data and you know, college, NBA, but if they weren't going to be able to use it, or if they were more focused on other things, then we didn't really want to put our time into something that they weren't going to be able to use.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And again, I don't want to get you into any kind of trouble or anything, but I know teams can be kind of secretive about things, so you mentioned that you interned with the Hornets. Did you find with them that it was similar in the sense that like that your work was kind of a conversation back and forth, or was it more directed by the coaching staff in terms of like, hey, we want you to go look at this? Or was it like, hey, we're thinking about doing this, and then essentially pursuing it from there?
I would say it was a little bit more kind of ad hoc, on the fly, go with the flow, kind of in college, at least at Davidson, just because, we're always adding new things. And so, you know, we weren't always like going by the book, you know, things that worked, you know, some of the scouting reports with advanced stats and whatnot, those things they liked and they liked to have around. And so those would stay. And then anything that we did that they enjoyed, you know, we did some shot charting stuff too. We added some kind of more detail to those as they've gone on. Those are another thing that kind of stuck around. And so really we were still, it's still growing as an analytics program at Davidson. While in Charlotte, I think there's much more, and I would guess is at a lot of NBA teams now that the analytics movement has gone far enough. I'm sure it's always still growing, but there's a lot more of a sense, at least to me, it felt like, of things that are expected. And there's a little bit more of a system of the way of doing things. And now it's just more of using those systems and maybe updating those systems to make better decisions.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So for anybody that's in college or soon to be in college that's listening, how did you go about getting involved with the basketball team and specifically working on the analytics with them?
Well, at first it was originally a lot of math major guys. Now we've got, not even just econ and math, but a whole range of even non-math related majors. But coming to college, I really enjoyed stats and I really enjoyed basketball, but I didn't really ever consider putting them together. And so for the first 2 years or so, I would only kind of do a little bit of research on my own, not really doing much. And then about halfway through my junior year, which, I should have done this a long time before that. It was a great experience. I reached out to one of the guys who started a blog by himself as an independent study called Davidson Analytics. And that was more of an attempt to capture analytics for, sports at Davidson. And then also an outlet for Davidson students to be able to publish their, any analysis for any sports that they did personally. And then I reached out to him and I just said, how many people do you have working on this blog? Is there any way that I could help? And he was abroad at the time, so he didn't really have anybody running it, but he just said, when I get back, I'm in the spring, come chat with me and we'll see what we can do. And so I spoke to him a couple times and I started working on, just some real simple analysis of a few things in the NBA. And then one of my swim teammates, actually, he was doing work with Professor Chartier, who runs the basketball analytics and now the whole analytics program there. And he was doing fantasy football research. He was a big, so it wasn't just limited to sports there, but he was, other like fantasy sports too. He was doing that. He's really big into fantasy football. And I said to him, I said, if Dr. Chartier needs any help with anything at all, I'll have some extra time this year. Just let him know and I can help him with whatever he needs. And so sure enough, that day, actually, when he went to go talk to him, I had then published some things for Nylon a couple months before, and Dr. Chartier had gotten an email from Jason Rosenfeld, the director of analytics at the NBA, and they had previously met and known each other. Jason had worked in Charlotte, and so they had met before. And Jason sent an email to Dr. Chartier and said, "Who is this kid at Davidson? I need to know what kind of work he's doing with you." And Dr. Chartier said, "I have no idea who this guy is, who this Max Szymanski kid is." And so, that same day, my teammate went and talked to him about me, and he said, "Oh, really? Well, yeah, I have him come talk to me." And so I went and talked to him, and he told me that he had, gotten an email from. Now, he didn't say who it was at the time, but he'd left the impression that it was someone fairly significant. And so from there, he just told me about the work that the basketball guys were doing. And at that time, there were probably 10 of us. And by the time I left in a year, there were probably 15 or 20. And it's only growing. And so that was kind of how, once I finally got connected with Dr. Chartier, I kind of put him in. I also kind of connected him with Seth. Seth Partnow. And from there, I kind of posted things running both on the Davidson kind of blog and a couple of things on Nylon as well. And then Dr. Shatir and I and Seth had a nice Skype chat. And so it was really funny how it all worked out. But I'm really glad it worked out the way it did.
Yeah, it seems like it was pretty fortuitous, and given how it all kind of fell together all in one day, it makes it seem almost fated.
It was wild.
So you mentioned that some of the writing you had done for Nylon helped you with the. I think initially you had done some freelance pieces, right? Like before you were actually on staff, you wrote a few things, but there. Is that were those pieces you were referring to, the freelance stuff that you had done?
Yes, but that summer before that year, I had saw that Nylon was asking for submissions, and so I did a little analysis and sent it to Seth and just said, "Hey, you know, I just want to know what you guys think of this. You don't have to run it or anything, but if you have any comments or some things to change, to edit, or ways that it could be better, let me know. And I'd love to hear what you have to think." And Seth emailed me back and said, "Now let's just run it. We'll run it on Friday. I really like it." So from there, I did maybe one more after that. And then school started. And so it slowed down a little bit, but, yeah, I think I had one or two freelance pieces before I started doing that at Davidson.
Yeah, so I looked back at some of your freelance stuff before we got on the chat, and I also it kind of flows together with some of the stuff that you've written about recently, and a lot of it is focused on the NBA sort of labor market and player valuation in dollars. Is there a reason specifically that interests you so much, or is it just kind of, I guess I'll not try to guess the answer and I'll just let you answer. What about that is so interesting to you?
I've always just been fascinated, especially within the last few years of, and given the circumstances of the NBA and the rising salary cap and whatnot. I'm so fascinated with the kinds of deals that players get and kind of the sentiments around who got a good deal, who got a bad deal, why did so-and-so get this deal, why did this guy get this when this guy is making this, even though player A is a better player than player B. And I think a lot of that is just from, I really like applied math, and that's one great application, at least for me, that's really interesting. That gets me excited to do analysis. And I'm really interested in doing, work that would apply to the front office. Being someone who's, now interned at Charlotte and seeing how the intricacies of an NBA front office works, there's no doubt in my mind that'd be something I could see myself doing.
Yeah, it makes total sense, especially, it sounds like you have aspirations of working, for a team in a front office capacity. So understanding the labor market is kind of one of the primary functions that an analytics department can sort of help with. I remember you had a piece, I think it ran in 2015, I'm not exactly sure when in 2015, I think it was relatively soon after free agency, basically kind of like looking at who was a bargain, who was a bad deal, based on like a pretty like, it was like a simple model of player value, but it explained like 80% of the variation in salary based on just a few variables. I think it was like usage
and like win shares and field goals and age.
Yeah.
And I don't know, something like that. There's a little bit of overlap in there. So that, R squared value might be a little bit inflated, but
yeah.
I was actually really surprised with given the the number of variables given how well the variation was exploited. And that could be just because the sample size was fairly small. But that was, you know, that's one thing I'm running into a little bit with the model I'm working on currently. I'm kind of releasing in pieces on Nylon called Dollars and Cents.
Yeah. So I was going to say that the thing that you, that first piece kind of reminded me a bit of another thing that Nick Restifo had written about, sort of objective draft grades, and his whole sort of philosophy around it being essentially that we all have these like gut instinct feelings or grades that are obviously based on some sort of mental model of, you know, what value is, and that's informed somewhat by actual numbers, but like putting it more into a more objective framework, I think was his goal with that. And I thought that was like a really good example of a very similar thing for the labor market, of like everybody wants to do these sort of like free agency grades, and a lot of it is like very subjective, and like there's
definitely, yeah.
So I thought that was definitely when you talk about applied math, that's definitely a cool application and a way to be a little bit more maybe rigorous in how you're thinking about things.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and, you know, that's the biggest thing, is that everybody wants to have that great signing and everybody wants to get the bargain on this guy. But at some point, and this is one of those things that's so hard to measure statistically, is that oftentimes in an auction market, such as, I mean, you know, kind of similar to NBA free agencies, sometimes you have to overpay for good players, and that's just the way that things are. If you want to secure their services, you know, you got to separate yourself some way, and that's one way to do it. That was one thing in the last post that I had about kind of player role and value in player role. I didn't want to necessarily penalize teams for overpaying quality players, just because, you know, a 5% overpay for LeBron is a lot different than a 5% overplay for a guy on the end of the bench.
Yeah, so that actually that leads nicely into the discussion that I wanted to get into a little bit about the sort of role adjusted player value model that you put together. I mean, I guess just to start things off, could you describe a little bit for the audience, maybe if they haven't had a chance to read your piece yet, how the model functions and, you know, what goes into it essentially?
Yeah, so it's the first of three models that will be kind of weighted and kind of blended together as one. And this one, each of the models spits out a kind of a player value in percentage of the cap. I wanted to do percentage of the cap so that you could more often than not compare across seasons in years that the cap was the same. I still did include cap level in the analysis, just to kind of control for, as the cap rises, you have more money to spend. The guys in that season are obviously probably going to get a little bit more inflated deals, as we've seen. And so with that first model, it does spit out a contract value, but I wanted to, in each of the three models, I wanted to display them in a way different than just dollars, because otherwise it's just three models kind of telling you the same thing with just different things put into them, different ways to kind of have them spit out a final value. And so the way I wanted to display that first model, I took kind of the ratio of the player's salary, so their expected salary over their actual salary, and then so you have a ratio there, and then a player's VORP value over replacement player is divided by this value. And so some good players who are underpaid, the goal for that is to have their value rise. And you know, players who are overpaid have their value, you know, their VORP fall. And so if you already have a really high VORP and you're overpaid, it's going to fall, but it's probably not going to bring you, you know, bring you down into the range of a bad player, essentially, unless you're, you know, unless you're, you know, Kobe and you're not playing any games and you're getting paid a ton of money. Then, you know, your value may fall a lot, but that was one way to kind of impose upon the model of the idea that sometimes you have to overpay for a good player. And if you overpay a little bit for a really good player, it's better than overpaying a little bit for a guy who's not going to play at all.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, one thing I noticed in the post that kind of jumped out to me, you can get into why this is, I guess, but you mentioned that by the look that you were looking at, that LeBron looks like he's a bit overpaid last year. Mm-hmm. And I found that interesting because, you know, the conventional wisdom and a very common talking point, in these kinds of discussions is that like a player like LeBron is, due to the salary cap, almost always going to be essentially undervalued, that he's going to be underpaid always. Now, what is it about the player value model that you had there that suggests that LeBron is actually slightly overpaid?
Well, probably one of the biggest things is that it's based on regular season data. I could somewhere down the line maybe include playoff data, but this model is just based on regular season data. And LeBron actually had one of his lower regular season outputs in his career this season, and so that's I think why he kind of took a hit in this model a little bit, why it showed him to be a little bit overpaid. But there are, and you know, this gets back to the old like, oh, they're all these things and analytics can't measure heart or can't measure leadership, or yes, it can't. And this is one of those few and far between cases where there's a lot of leadership qualities and a lot of intangibles that LeBron brings to the table that's incredibly hard to statistically model. And so even though he's, even though his value has dropped down a little bit, his intangibles combined with that regular season, his regular season output, kind of dropped his value. And in the playoffs, he's a completely different monster. It's almost like he can go 75% for most of the regular season and turn it on in the playoffs and reach a level that we only see when he plays in the playoffs.
Yeah. So I think that makes sense, but LeBron's VORP, even though it was kind of low for him, was still pretty good. So is part of the sort of him being overpaid a function of the fact that you're accounting for role? So like he's a star player and he is paid, now that he's in Cleveland, he is paid sort of the most that he could possibly get. Whereas, you know, before, like when he was in Miami, that he took that pay cut or whatever, and he was obviously even more productive. Is that also kind of driving it to suggest that he's, I guess, slightly overpaid, other than like beyond the fact that he's less productive than he in the regular season than he has been? Is the role adjustment playing a part there?
I would certainly agree with that. And the model doesn't pinpoint roles perfectly, but I would think it does a pretty good job especially with someone like LeBron. He might be in the star, he might be in the star grouping or the star cluster, but both in Miami and in Cleveland, when you're playing with multiple other all-stars, multiple other guys who are so incredibly talented, that's going to affect your output in some way. Maybe not necessarily your advanced percentage stats, like assist percentage and rebound percentage and whatnot, but it's still going to affect your role in some way, and all three of those guys will affect each other. And I think that's also where he's going to take a hit. Maybe a single star may be better off in the model than like a big three, for example.
That makes sense. There's always sort of the concern when you put multiple sort of star players together about I guess there's like an overlap issue in terms of their just raw productivity that you see sometimes, and that happened with LeBron in Miami, and then when he returned to Cleveland, there was some of that. One of the other things that kind of jumped out to me about the role adjusted player value model was it looked like Rudy Gobert, if I was reading the chart right, it looked like Rudy Gobert was the most valuable player under sort of that look by the value of his contract and his role and sort of how productive he is. I think that is another one that kind of bucks the conventional wisdom a little bit. I know most people, when you hear them talk about it, say the best contract in the league is, you know, Stephen Curry, you know, on his, I think it's like $11 million a year deal.
Right.
Do you think that, I guess, what is the reasoning for Gobert being, under this view, being even more valuable than say, Steph?
Well, one thing I tried to account for in the model, which is incredibly difficult, is defense. And you know, as we've heard in just last episode, Andrew Johnson talked about it. It's so incredibly difficult to try and use defense to, you know, and use defense in models and just come up with good, you know, defensive metrics. And so I think that's one place where Gobert really dwarfs Steph. And that's not to say, I mean, I'm one of the big proponents of Steph being an incredibly great defender, even though he's, you know, kind of thin and not that big. But the guy has, I mean, he has incredible defensive instincts. He has great hands. Yeah, that's one of like my pet peeves is like Steph Curry isn't a good defender. That's silly. But in terms of just positional and role value, Rudy Gobert is a very good defensive player, at least in terms of his defensive metrics. And on top of that, he's fairly efficient as well, at least in terms of, you know, percentage wise stats, which is what the model is kind of based around. Especially, you know, things like block percentage and like rebounding, and so I think those things are where he kind of dwarfs Steph. Certainly, I know field goals was part of the model too, but the fact that he just completely outweighs a lot of people in the model based on defense, I think that's what really brings up his value. And the same with a lot of other defensive players in the model, Paul Millsap, or good defensive players, Paul Millsap, Draymond Green, guys that we don't often see get big paychecks, at least historically. Now are starting to a little bit. Kawhi is a fantastic defender. He's, you know, he's got the max. You know, Draymond just got a brand new big deal. Millsap just got paid. And so I pondered to myself, actually, in the precursor post to the first model, of is it that GMs are starting to finally kind of value defense a little bit more than they previously have, or is it just because these players' offensive skills have also kind of caught up with their defensive skills, like, and that, or maybe they've just been finally noticed.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of it. With Gobert, he makes even less than Steph, right? Like, is that another thing that sort of drives his like valuation in terms of that model, in terms of him, I guess, being kind of even more of a bargain?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. That's definitely one of his. And as you know, as the cap increases, you know, his salary of like, I think he got this past year got paid like just under like 1.2 or something ridiculous. That you know, I think as the cap increases, that only makes him more and more valuable.
Yeah, because he was like mid first rounder, I think, like not even, I don't even think he was a lottery pick. I think he was like slightly outside of the lottery pick, which gets into like just how important it is to draft well, because if you hit on those, you get all the surplus value. So
yeah, I think he was the end of the first rounder. But yeah, I mean, those, when you hit on the end of the first round, second round at all, that's, I mean,
yeah. So he even bigger bargain than I was remembering. So you mentioned actually the discussion that I had with Andrew from the last episode, and I kind of wanted to pick your brain about that a little bit. So his post that he had written about sort of how much we can explain based on what we know about individual player defense is, you know, statistically significantly lower than what we can say about offense. And we had sort of a philosophical discussion around like whether we'd ever be able to really say that defense was, I guess, that you could pinpoint how valuable any individual person was to a defense, because it is more of a group activity. And it does seem to be the case that the offense actually controls the result a lot more than the defense. And based on some stuff that I guess Ken Palm had written, and then just Andrew's own research. This is all of a kind of a long way to say that you mentioned in your first Dollars and Cents piece that from Mika Honkasalo, I hope I said his last name right, he wrote about basically that defense is paid about 40% less than offense of comparable impact. And I was just curious your thoughts on whether or not that's just a function of us not being able to measure it that well, or if it's actually the case that no, like really offense should be paid more because it's more portable and it's more reliable, that you can just grab a guy and his offense will translate. Whereas defense, you know, it's really about fit and how well he can master a scheme and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think that's one of those things that I've wrestled with before. I think where I'm at least right now in terms of thought on defense is that I think top end defenders are incredibly valuable, especially when you have talents like LeBron or KD, or, you know, guys that can switch and play multiple positions on the wing. You need flexible elite defenders on the wing to be able to do that. And I think that's just so much more valuable now than it's ever been in the history of basketball. And so I think those guys are seeing their value increase. I don't know about your normal above average defenders. I don't know if they're seeing quite the same increase in their value just because of where we are right now in kind of basketball evolution, if you will. But yeah, I would hope that defense would eventually be able to be paid equally as offense. I just don't know if we're ever going to be able to come up with anything that can explain that's widely used. You know, maybe on little things, you know, maybe with more tracking data, eventually stats metrics will be developed, for certain defensive measures. But a lot of defense is really just athleticism and footwork, and a lot of it, I mean, you can see this in the playoffs, a lot of it is effort. And with things such as variable as that, it's always going to be difficult to measure defense in that sense.
Yeah, I think that the effort thing is something that like is commonly mentioned as being a big part of defense, and I think I agree, but I always put a caveat on that of that it's got to be effort that is directed in the right direction. So like smart effort, I guess, I think is right, incredibly right. Important, because I just always flash back to the last few seasons that Andres Nocioni was playing for the Bulls, who right. are the team I follow the most closely. And, you know, Nocioni was worked very, very hard on defense, but he was all over the place and chased the ball a lot. And he was just kind of a disaster on defense. And it wasn't for a lack of effort. It was just like, you know, he wasn't really playing smart. And so I think that's like the, I guess the piece that has to go with the effort is, you know, you have to have the athleticism, you have to have the effort, and then you have to have the smart. So it's like those three things together are really, I think, pretty hard to find, you know, on a consistent basis. But apparently the Warriors have figured out some magic to find it, find it all the time.
That's right. And that whole system is just, I mean, Steve Kerr has done such a great job with the whole defensive system there. And, you know, it's a copycat league. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be rotating again and following that. You know, one thing I'm really excited for the league about that actually is that now the defense is kind of, the metrics are starting to kind of appear a little bit, you know, with a little bit more tracking. I'm going to bet some in-house teams have some ways to kind of measure this a little bit more. I'm kind of excited with the hustle stats that have been used in summer league. I don't know what's actually going to come about them, but I almost think of that as like a basketball special teams, if you will. Your screen assists, I mean, closeouts could technically be seen as defense, but kind of things that don't really fall into either side necessarily that can be measured.
Yeah, I mean, like anything that's like a 50-50 situation where there's a loose ball is kind of by definition neither offense or defense. It's because the ball is not possessed by anybody at that moment. So that does become sort of analogous to football special teams, I guess. One of the other things that I was thinking about when we were having the discussion around defense is just kind of because we were talking about Steve Kerr and the system that they've put into place. Now, I was actually thinking about two different coaches, but they are very similar, and I think they actually are of the same coaching tree. Is, you know, you're the coach you just worked with down in Charlotte, Steve Clifford, and Tom Thibodeau, and, you know, we got into discussing the importance of athleticism, effort, and smarts, and I think that the thing that Thibodeau and Clifford both seem to do so well is if a player has athletic limitations, they manage to overcome that by with their schemes. But then the other thing that they both seem to do incredibly well is they are sticklers about effort. So if you're not competing on the defensive end from an effort perspective, you get sat down. And they're so precise about their drilling of guys in terms of where their footwork needs to be, where they need to be on the floor. And the precision of that is essentially how you direct that effort. And that's one of the things, like, I think, like, it's kind of a conventional wisdom thing, but I actually think it might be, you know, conventional wisdom for good reason, that I think coaches seem to have more influence on, at least just from my own subjective thought process on it, they seem to have the more influence on defense. That'd be an interesting thing to be studied. I think it'd be tough to sort of isolate a coach's influence, but it'd be a cool thing to sort of see.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I've heard some studies measure a coach's influence as much as like another all-star. I don't know if that's 100% true, but I mean, it could be up to that, maybe, depending on who the coach is. But yes, and I think I agree with that. In order to be a good defensive coach, in order to have players fit into the scheme and play well within the scheme, it's effort and it's discipline, which are, I mean, two of the main qualities of defense. If you have the athleticism and you have discipline and you put forth the effort, it's pretty hard to fail as a defensive player. You know, the discipline kind of goes into playing smart defense, if you will. Being in the right place, you know, understanding certain players' tendencies. I think that the discipline involved in that goes into being a smart defender.
For sure. So I just want to circle back a little bit to the roll adjusted value and sort of the your dollars and cents post. I'm curious, are there particular teams that you've noticed have done a, just looking, because I know you've only, like, the data that you're looking at is just from this current collective bargaining agreement, but there, are there particular teams that you've noticed have done a better job than others at consistently getting good role adjusted value from their contracts?
Mostly the Cavaliers have done a great job, at least recently, and that's probably has to do somewhat with LeBron. Having him out there is like having another coach on the floor. Even role players, I think, just perform so much better with him around, just because he makes sure they're in the right spots and he can get them the ball when they are in the right spots. And then obviously the San Antonio Spurs as well. They've done a really good job, just efficiency. And that's a lot of the guys, just because, like, you know, Timmy D has taken a pay cut multiple times, and so has Manu. And, you know, those kinds of things really kind of show through kind of on analyses kind of like this, where players take pay cuts, but they're still of value of a, you know, maybe mid salary to almost max player when they're getting paid a fraction of that.
Yeah, it certainly helps to whether that's through, whether you want to say that's through culture or just being lucky in the sense of having a guy like a Tim Duncan that places a much higher value or much higher utility on being in the same place and his relationship with Popovich, or whether you don't say it's luck and you say, well, they've established that relationship and that's something they've really cultivated. However you want to play it, like, it's very hard to imagine other teams maybe being able to replicate something like that, but or replicating LeBron. Short of cloning LeBron, I don't know that we're going
right.
to replicate him. So, yeah, it's tough out there being a GM, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Next part of this model is next will be kind of by position. So first adjusted for role, next will be by position. I think the way that data will probably be displayed is I'm going to kind of take the average for each position and show kind of the deviation from the mean, you know, expected salary in each position. And then the final part will be kind of similarities between, you know, similar players. So similar values among similar players to a specific player. And then that value will kind of get pumped into the model and all will kind of get blended together to come out with one value for the player, and that'll be the final model.
That's I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of the series. But before we close out, I wanted he's your Twitter avatar, so I have to ask a question about Giannis.
Okay.
Over under for his box plus minus next year, 3.5. Do you have it over or under?
I mean, it might be the homer in me, but I'm gonna say over.
Yeah, I just, optimism.
I just feel like with the way he's going, I think he's really committed to becoming, you know, a real star in the league. And, you know, I think with the scheme, with him handling the ball, I think that's somewhere where he could really flourish. Yeah, as we saw kind of near the end of the season, I know it's a small sample size. But I guess that's half of me, you know, the optimistic side of me just in terms of unbiased, and then the other half of kind of the homer pushing through saying, oh, yeah, they're all going to be great.
Yeah, I think I'm really hoping that the signing of Dele does not mean that they're going to take the ball out of Giannis's hands. I really hope that it, what it really means is that Dele is going to kind of play the role that he played when LeBron was handling the ball when he was in Cleveland, and also kind of like the the Patrick Beverley to James Harden role in the sense of, you know, give your big wing guy that can dribble the ball and have the point guard play defense and kind of spot up. Also known as the John Paxson role from the teams when Pippen was kind of like the de facto point guard.
That's right.
Yeah, I really hope they keep the ball in Giannis's hands, and hopefully our buddy Seth Partno in the Milwaukee front office is you know, relaying our sentiments.
That's right. I'll have to, they're coming to they'll be in Madison for training camp. I'll have to see if I can't snag Seth and Mike Clutterbuck, see if I can't get any inside info.
Well, yeah, or maybe ideally you want to snag Jason Kidd and be like, hey, make sure Giannis stays to the point guard.
That's right. That's right.
Because I imagine J. Kidd will have the largest say in determining that.
Yes, the point guard whisperer.
All right.
Even when you're not Giannis.
yeah. Giannis, he has so much potential. I am looking forward to his season. I really hope that the Bucks make the playoffs, honestly, and that's not just because I like Mike Clutterbuck, and you know, obviously we have the nylon connection of having Seth on staff, but you know, I just think that they're a fun team, and I would like to see them on national TV, like, for at least a 7-game series.
Yes, definitely.
And that's probably heresy for me to say as a Bulls fan, but the Bulls had a horrible offseason, and I don't expect them to make the playoffs. So I'm rooting for fun instead.
Fun is always good.
Yeah. All right, Maxwell. I think that's about it. But I just want to remind everybody to follow Max on Twitter at ShyMax. And again, that's ShyMax, and look out for the rest of his posts in the Dollar and Cents series. It's been really good. If you haven't read the first two posts, then you should definitely go do that. Max, do you have anything else that you wanted to say before we go?
Posts 3 and 4 should be out soon for the series. Thanks for having me on. This was a blast. First time. I'll have to come back for more.
Yeah, for sure. I think you know, I'm expecting that you'll write more for the site, and at the very least, come March Madness time, I'll have to have you on to discuss your March Madness model that you put together while at Davidson.
Yeah, I'll have to update that one and come out with the second version of those picks this year. That's a fun hobby of mine, jumping over to the college side.
Yeah, definitely. All right, Max. Well, like I said, great having you on, and we'll talk soon.
Yep. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks.